So this is side two of session 35, recorded on April 2nd, 2007. And to continue what we were saying at the end of side one, we were talking about the orality and the harmony of orality and visuality in the medieval culture, and perhaps in the Greek culture, not in the Rome culture. But if you bring in the effect of the printing press and the kind of human that shows up, at least the social manners, from, 17th, 18th century, he would look quite, maybe in quotes, Puritan, compared to the multi-sensual Greek or the medieval culture. Especially when you think of the Greeks, they seem to have no problem with homosexuality. And so they didn't have definite categories, at least for something, sexual relations between men and female. So they weren't as precise in their visual boundaries. So therefore, they were less subjected to the effects of visual space like the Puritan and Victorian British cultures and the Catholic culture in Europe. So that lack of precision and definition led to alluring of sexual relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So they were more multi-sensuous compared to a visually post-print visually biased person in the 17th, 18th century.
Yeah. When was Shakespeare? He was 1700s?
No, Shakespeare was 1564 to 1616.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because he's still, there's a lot of vulgarity and multisensuality in Shakespeare, but yet the visual, the literature's, of course, Mary.
Yeah, no, it wasn't necessarily literature. He was just performing plays.
Mm-hmm.
Not literature when the later people write, Francis Bacon, them start editing it and putting it in manuscript. I mean, it was a manuscript form or a folio when Shakespeare's doing it, but a lot of it was winging it as he created theater.
Mm.
But yeah, McLuhan celebrates the Elizabethan multi-sensuous reality compared to the 17th or 18th century.
Mm-hmm. So when were the illuminated manuscripts? Those would have been...
That's pre-printing press. That's before the printing press.
Well, yeah. But, McLuhan would have liked that, too, because you're balancing.
It's not a matter of liking. You'd appreciate the balance of sensory ratios.
Yeah, well, it's pleasing, and one person would like that.
No, he likes the 20th century, too.
Mm.
No, he says imagination is that faculty not embedded in the senses or the extension of the senses, so... Liking implies embedment. No, you get a sensory pleasure from it. It's not that he would say the medieval world was better than our time.
Mm-hmm.
He thought this was the greatest time because of the multi-sensuous reality that we lived in. People didn't understand it, so that created a lot of pain.
Well, Zappa's criticism was, relevant, which was the... He was talking about the 60s, but this was going on long before the 60s, how, the advertising was used to just program mediocrity into people's minds, to program a kind of common, a lowest common denominator and sort of through, repetition, the world becomes kind of bland.
Well, I saw Zappa as his social criticism was a bit anemic, single-leveled. He actually had a 19th century individualist view,
mm-hmm.
and he thought there weren't enough. He was projecting what I would call a visual bias of the 19th century on the multi-sensuous activities of modern life, so that what he saw as uniformity really was multi-leveled, but he couldn't see it because he was a specialist in music and very intense and specialized intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
But he was naturally, maybe because he didn't go to university or being an Italian-American, he was naturally a multi-sensuous person just by being in music. That made him more multi-sensuous than... writers or visually biased media people. But he had an American sensibility, and some people would say it was an old-fashioned sensibility. He believed in the individual. He was alienated from the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Not his technology for making his art, but in his social, his description of the social. He thought there still was a social. He thought it was becoming moronic and mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly didn't use McLuhan's standards in understanding the present. He used humanist 19th century values.
Mm-hmm.
So, but his music was incredibly tactile. So probably, since he never, he says in the interview Bob Marshall did with him that he never read or knew anything about symbolist critics or any of that stuff that McLuhan uses as sources. He wasn't educated in that way.
Mm-hmm.
He just was a working man,
mm-hmm.
totally tuned into the potential of efficient causality instruments for making great music. He was a craftsman.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have a sophisticated multicultural view that Zappa had. I mean, that McLuhan had, as he dealt with the each culture as expressing particular sensory bias and then the media mixing on top of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't it seem strange that they sort of became friends on the astral plane?
Yes, they are opposites, and they did make fun of each other, you know, on the astral plane through GLOW.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I never went into it much, but I was looking at it that way. I mean, most people thought, oh, Frank's a genius, McLuhan's a genius, but I was looking at actually what was going on through GLOW, the charades they're putting on. Actually, in its sense, McLuhan was the older, more aware of the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Zappa was always reacting. As a matter of fact, GLOW didn't like Zappa. He was always being male chauvinist with her.
Yeah, misogynistic.
Yeah. So, there was that level in those, whatever you want to call GLOW was doing, seeing these ghosts do these charades.
Mm-hmm.
You could read it that way. Zappa was the immature one. I mean, that's what Jerry Fialka said. He started reading McLuhan. He says, holy geez, this is way beyond what Frank says.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that Zappa could use the modern media and remain in the media longer than McLuhan because he had a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a master of modern electric technology.
Yeah. Well, you know, you don't have to be a great intellectual to be a great musician. A favorite jazz musician of mine is Art Pepper. He's a saxophone player. And I was just hearing that they were doing a little review of his one of those little 30-second dedications on the radio today, and they're talking about how his wife got him a gig, his first gig in a recording studio, and you know, he hadn't picked up a saxophone in 6 months. He was on heroin. He was exhibiting criminal behavior. The guy just wasn't, you know, he was not an intellectual. He got into the recording studio, and he's in there with Miles Davis and the top jazz musicians of the time, and he picks up, his saxophone is broken, so somebody gives him a saxophone, and he just starts wailing with the best of them like he'd never skipped a beat. So who knows where musical talent comes from, but it doesn't necessarily make you mean that you're a wise like McLuhan.
Well, no, that's not the McLuhan. We have to look at what McLuhan was wise about. I mean, he was not in one culture. A jazz musician is one culture.
Mm-hmm.
He's American. He grew up in the cities or whatever, and he's part of the street, and he knows how to play the instrument in that environment and create new music. So was Zappa. They were going around studying different cultures. Zappa was studied or listened to all kinds of international music. So he was really well-versed in that. But McLuhan was a different kind of mind. I don't even know if it was intellectual. He was just something talking on a whole, you could say, big scale that was way beyond what particular cultures thought was going on. So Zappa speaks as an American archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Of a certain, I mean, some biographers call him, he was in the tradition of the average inventor, the tinkerer, you know, the eccentric guy who invents things in his garage.
Yeah.
That 19th century kind of vision of Americans. And McLuhan wasn't anything. He just looked at, he processed information from all over the world and created these big patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a different level of awareness. And it's like he covered more areas because he wrote about them. And anybody who knew something about a particular area of experience or study would read McLuhan and say, well, McLuhan got it all wrong. McLuhan doesn't know anything about my field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Zappa thought that McLuhan was odd, like slightly brain damaged when he saw him in Stephanie McLuhan's documentary.
Mm-hmm.
He told me that in 85. He said, looked like McLuhan wasn't all there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you see that McLuhan was talking to Americans and addressing their bias, their sensory peculiarities, and then relating it to other cultures, it's like an alien talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, if McLuhan was presenting something that no one had done before, you can only have done in the 20th century. So, Zappa was a self-studied musician who was aware of the history of music and was upgrading music.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm talking about his social criticism about American lifestyle. I mean, it wasn't that unique in the way he criticized the over-materialism, over-consumerism, over-mediocrity. You get that every day from people.
Yeah.
From critics or writers or movie makers. But they don't fully understand the dynamics of the information environment like McLuhan did.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't propose a new kind of economics. Okay, so let's...
Okay.
So we were just doing... I was describing the dark side of sumptuary excess and decline, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the vibrating set of particles.
The world of Hobbes. Is that Thomas Hobbes? Or
yeah. That might is right.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that's the Reaganism.
Now, has come full circle when the, in parentheses, postmodern self is endlessly reproduced as vibrating set of particles, etc. So, postmodern self, what is he referring to when he uses the word self?
Well, it's not a chemical body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, in McLuhan terms, a discarnate self. He calls it a fractal entity.
Mm-hmm.
He's always describing this new self in different ways.
Mm. But it's not a personal self. He's not referring to his own self as a unique individual or a person.
He's saying there isn't any at this point in the 80s. He's saying that the self is a vibrating set of particles.
But doesn't self imply self-aware? Isn't a self an entity, a creature? Sounds like he's talking about, you know, collective phenomena.
I'm talking about a self, but the self is not a. The self is aware, but not aware of the environment it's become.
Hmm. Whose self, though? Is he, whose self?
Okay. The next paragraph maybe describes it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if it does.
Okay.
Because I see the phrase postmodern body. He says, thus power from the bounded, reserved, and inert. So that's the old version of self. Chemical body, bounded, reserved, and inert, flips now into its opposite sign, the domain of the unbounded, spent, and violent.
Mm-hmm.
And what better exemplar of the unreal world of the social, see, it's unreal, in this condition, and what better exemplar of the unreal world of the social in this condition than music? See, vibrating set of particles, music slash vibration, a servo mechanism, enters directly into the postmodern body and passes through it without a trace, leaving only an altered energy state. There's your vibrating set of particles. That's all you are. That's all yourself is. Everywhere music creates the mood, the energy level of the postmodern scene. Never seen, but equally never shut out. Music, as panic vibrations, secretes through the body of the social. So he's mixing up the personal self and the social self.
Mm-hmm.
And they merge.
social collective or the mass man or...
Yeah, and so he's describing McLuhan's discarnate state, just with a little more particular details.
Yeah.
Because he says it's always ready to enter, music is always ready to enter, it is also always ready to circulate. Being itself possessed, it does money one better by creating social relations which require no possessions. McLuhan talked about that. When you have a software environment, you don't need to own anything because you have access to it. You don't lose it, the information environment. So it's better. Music creates social relations which require no possessions. It may be, quote, born in the USA, but it has become universal. Always in time, it finally prepares for the abandonment of history, which is visual space. Music, then, with no past, no future, no determinate meaning, but perfectly defining, perfectly energizing, perfectly postmodern. The liberal burnout of contemporary culture is taking the spectral forms, therefore, of fractal subjects, there's yourself, fun vibrations and panic noise. So the culture and the self are almost made up of those three aspects. The liberal burnout of contemporary culture is taking the spectral forms, therefore, of fractal subjects, fun vibrations, and panic noise. That's you.
Mm-hmm.
You're made up of...
Well, it's one level. I mean, you're still made up of... you still have, you know, possessions still come into play. You know, you still need a car to get around. And you
well, that would be older media. There's still older media, like in nature. If you have a new form of nature, it doesn't necessarily get rid of the older form
right.
of nature.
But I think the problem that I have with some of the way that this is articulated is that it makes you forget about, makes you want to, it seems to exclude physical reality as though it doesn't exist any longer.
Well, that's true. Now, remember, this is in terms of people communicating with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any reality in social communication in the last 20 years? Most people say, nah. You hear people talk. Everybody's in a fantasy world. Everybody's just, they say it in the bars and taverns.
Mm-hmm.
They say it in the gyms. It's like a intuition, a perception. They don't...
Right.
They still go around... trying to figure out what they are in that, but
yeah.
they don't understand.
But everyone still has attention on their physicality because
what'd you say?
Everyone still has attention on their physical needs and getting them
well,
met.
Well, what they perceive, that's like an after image.
Oh, yeah.
They
well,
perceive their after image.
I don't know about that. When you have an abscess tooth, I don't know if you that.
No, like phantom pain. McLuhan used to talk about phantom pain.
Right.
Legs get amputated, you still think you got a leg there.
Right.
Well, sociality. People think there's still a social there, but it's just a phantom pain. And you, why does the whole population end up on drugs?
Yeah.
Different levels of drugs. Way beyond than they did 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So you just take an inventory of our time.
Well, what do you call what we're doing right now? This is a form of social.
Well, we're just two people
socializing.
Like in the movie Life of Brian, those two workers at the in the gladiator place, and they're talking philosophy with each other, and then their boss gladiator walks by, and they suddenly start talking like two retards.
Yeah,
they hide. Well, that's what we do. We go in public. We act like a retard.
Right.
You know, act like a dumb shit, and they won't bother you. But in private, we're having these little secret, promiscuous discussions.
Right.
Like those two guys. And when they're private, they talk, and they talk on a different level than their social image.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way people are today. They communicate a lot of stuff privately, but they look conformist in public.
Sure.
Because there's the age of uncertainty. You don't know what the person next to you is going to do.
Right. It's almost cliche, you know. He seemed like such a nice boy.
Yeah. And he mowed down 400 people in high school.
Yeah.
And it's not that people say, well, nothing's changed, but the media just talks some more about it, this or that. Nah. He didn't have people, little kids mowing down. They didn't even have guns, you know, before. Mm. Now they got guns and they mow down their classmates. Something, there's some kind of panic going on there that we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it might be caused by the drugs they're taking. The Prozac or whatever kids take.
Mm-hmm.
been shown to make it quite psychotic.
Well, that coupled with the media environment, which is whatever disappeared state it.
Yeah, no social. There's an example of no social restraints. If you feel like killing people, you do.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seem real to you. No reality principle.
Mm.
So let's go into panic waiting.
Panic waiting. Colville. Alex Colville.
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 He's a Canadian painter.
Oh.
Based in Nova Scotia.
Uh-huh.
And so Coker has some images of his painting in the book.
Mm.
And he's analyzing them.
Alex Colville's painting, Woman in a Bathtub.
Woman in Bathtub.
Oh, yeah. Woman in Bathtub is a powerful evocation of the postmodern mood. Here, everything is a matter of canceled identities. And in parentheses, the background figure has no head. The woman's gaze is averted. Silence.
Yeah, everything is a matter of canceled identities. Silence.
Right. And then in parentheses, broken only by the ocular sounds of surveillance.
End of quote. End of parentheses.
Yeah. So it's, here everything is a matter of canceled identities, silence, and waiting with no expectation of relief. And then in bold print, in The Will to Power,
Nietzsche,
yeah, spoke eloquently and prophetically of a new dark age, which would be typified by passive nihilists driven by despair over their own botched and bungled instincts toward predatory styles of behavior, and by suicidal nihilists who would always prefer to will nothingness rather than not will at all. Following Nietzsche, Woman in Bathtub,
the painting,
mm-hmm, is a haunting image of
both of the
postmodern self as catastrophe site and of the meaning of paradox as deepest language of postmodernism.
The deepest language of postmodernism.
Mm-hmm. In this artistic production, and aesthetics of seduction, in parentheses, the muted colors of cool art, counterpoints the presence of inner decay, and the promise of human companionship as reciprocity is immediately canceled by the reality of communication as radical isolation.
So there's the very death of the social that we were talking about, presented in a painting.
Mm-hmm.
The death of interpersonal communication.
Right.
So I'm going to read that quote again. Panic waiting. Alex Colville's painting, Woman in Bathtub, is a powerful evocation of the postmodern mood. So it's describing the mood of the 80s. Here, everything is a matter of canceled identities. The background figure has no head. That actually is the husband or boyfriend in the painting. The woman's gaze is averted. So it's a matter of canceled identities. Silence, broken only by the ocular or eye sounds of surveillance. And waiting with no expectation of relief. In The Will to Power, Nietzsche spoke eloquently and prophetically of a new dark age which would be typified by passive nihilists italicized, driven by despair over their own botched and bungled instincts towards predatory styles of behavior, and the other type, suicidal nihilists, in italics, who would always prefer to will nothingness rather than not will at all. Following Nietzsche, Woman in Bathtub is a haunting image both of the postmodern self as a catastrophe site and of the meaning of paradox as the deepest language of postmodernism. In this artistic production, an aesthetics of seduction, the muted colors of cool art, describing the painting, counterpoints the presence of inner decay. Read that again. An aesthetics of seduction, the muted colors of cool art, counterpoints the presence of inner decay. And the promise of human companionship as reciprocity is immediately canceled by the reality of communication as radical isolation. Now, as I described earlier, moving into the voluntary ESP phase, where people are atomized and fragmented, that leads to radical isolation.
Yeah, canceled by the reality of communication as radical isolation.
Yeah, there's no reciprocity. So what's interesting is the digital comes in and creates interactive media. Mm-hmm. There's more and more sense of isolation, even though you can interact with more.
Yeah, because more and more of a sense of everyone's in their own bubble.
Yeah, and actually he's describing the 80s. This is before. It's really before the interactive digital media. So it's like the last phase of the analog media.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty bleak description of us, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, but it's accurate.
Well, yeah. It's only because this passive nihilism and suicidal nihilism or nihilism has only intensified the last decade.
Yeah.
I read a statistic that, you know, I mean, suicide is just epidemic right now around the world.
Yeah.
And then you have people that are just the opposite. Rather than just passively taking their own life, they're going to go out with a gun and take out everybody they can around them.
Like in Iraq.
Yeah. Like in Iraq, yeah. It seems I came across this comment by someone who was talking about postmodernism, and he was saying that Islam, you know, they're sort of guided by this logocentric voice, which sort of, you know, it lays down the law, and then everybody knows, you know, everybody has the same rules to follow, and they can sort of conform and feel a sense of community. And the postmodern spirit, born of technology, and as you point out, the Android meme, fragmenting everyone into their own little, you know, isolated unit, is really confronting to logocentric.
A challenge.
Yeah. And so naturally they're going to feel threatened, and the desire to, you know, somehow attack the thing that's threatening their culture. But, you know, how can you attack the Android meme? I mean,
yeah.
So
how can you attack vibrating particles?
Yeah, right. So that would lead to this, you know, panic underlying, you know,
the theme of this book.
Right, the theme of Croker's book.
So it's not so far off.
Yeah.
It's a bit ahead of its time, describing what's coming,
mm-hmm.
seeing the first inklings of it in the 80s.
Yeah.
So when he talks about the postmodern mood, that's another way of saying what the self is. It's a mood. Because in the next quote, from the section called Panic Questions, he kind of describes the oscillation in this self,
yeah.
which is postmodern mood.
Right. Because that mood is pervasive. I mean, it becomes the environment just as much as the air and, you know, the ground that you stand on.
What you breathe.
Yeah. But the thing about, well, he was talking about the music setting the mood. Still, you have people that, you know, they don't pay attention to contemporary music. They have a huge collection of classical music, and that's what they listen to. So I don't know that everyone is universally affected by and in music at any one time you have all different genres going on and everything, so I don't know that it's everyone's being permeated or
they're all listening to music in different electronic media,
right,
even in soundtracks and TV.
yeah but the postmodern quality of the music is what again, destroys the cultural heritage or roots of the music. I came across in this introducing postmodernism, the author was saying that he was talking about this kind of sacred music from the Sufis, which was could incite, you know, religious ecstasy in the participants, and it, you know, had this deep sense of, you know, belonging to the ancestors, and it was treated, you know, very sacredly. And then you know, some modern recording engineers got a hold of it, they thought it was fantastic. They created five versions of it, one with a kind of disco beat, one with a kind of rap style, one with, you know, they took this music and made five permutations of it so that it could permeate five different cultures. Well, at that point, the only thing that the music has in common is the fact that it's been sort of recombined to with the flavor of the postmodern age.
Now, you said common. It has in common with what?
With its the five different flavors of Sufi music. They don't. Each one doesn't really have these. Each one maybe has in some sense the essence or the spirit of the original music that the culture practiced that created a sense of communion among members of the culture. But now the thing that distinguishes it is the fact that it has been that it's now postmodern, that it's now
mutated
and
you're saying there's five different
recombinant
Sufi. What?
Recombinant.
Yeah, it's five different Sufi variations.
Yeah, you know, they translated it into you know, ghetto street for the rappers, and they translated it into a kind of a disco beat for the disco parlors, and they translated it into, you know, some kind of a, you know, pop flavor for pop culture. So that, you know, everybody gets to experience this wonderful music, but there's not much left of the original spirit of the
right,
music.
Right, it's put in their context.
Yeah.
That's tetrad management, adapting it to the ground of your particular audiences.
Yeah.
What's your problem with that? That
it
definitely ain't
meaning. I think it loses its meaning. The only thing that it really says anymore, the only spirit that it really communicates, is the postmodern spirit of fragmentation.
Right, but when you said it loses meaning, but not meaning for those that are responding in their disco or ghetto context.
Yeah, no, I guess it takes on a new.
It's like
becomes a sliding signifier. It takes on a new meaning for whoever hears it.
What it really is that all. Just as nature and humans became the content of the industrial age, in the electric age and the digital age, all media, including previous cultures, become the content and are mutated,
mm-hmm.
altered. So Sufi, Catholic hymns, whatever, is processed through the sampler and the digital machine and loses its original context. And is adapted and exploited or processed through the meat grinder of whatever different media environments it's being designed for.
Mm-hmm.
So it loses its, not meaning, it loses itself.
Yeah.
Cultural self.
Yeah. And if we can say that that's what happens for music, which is an aspect of culture, it happens to all. All different aspects of cultures get mutated and recombined, and then there's no sense of history anymore.
Like you said, music then with no past, no future, no determinate meaning.
Yeah,
and he's describing the postmodern music, but perfectly defining, perfectly energizing, energizes the disco, energizes the ghetto,
right.
Perfectly postmodern.
Right.
So that's why we call it ecstasy.
Right.
I call it this period. We're all in a state of ecstasy. But that's going to be discussed in the next quote. So maybe we should go to that. I don't know if there's much to say what we just read about panic waiting, just that we're waiting.
Mm-hmm.
In panic. Panic Godot.
Yeah.
You want to go on to the next one?
Yeah.
I think you're starting to get what he's saying, and he's repeating it throughout the different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
See? Let's read this one. Panic.
Well, so then we all become like surfers. I mean, there's nothing to contemplate anymore in terms of meaningfulness of...
There's nothing to contemplate in terms of visually biased humanist meaning. There, you can still contemplate what you're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just that you're using... your mind is not limited to a book page.
Yeah, and it's not limited to the narrative, the storyline of how you got here and who your family tree and like all that used to mean a lot to people, you know.
Right, now it's a pattern of what you consume,
mm-hmm.
the different media. Look at MySpace. Don't the kids list their best movies and the best this, best records?
Yeah.
All their favorite media. That's their self.
Yeah.
Their self being a processor of all those environments.
Hmm.
And those groups and bands that they list evoke certain moods and implications and inside or outside groups, insider circles or outside, depending on the person reading the MySpace, right?
Yeah. But it's not necessarily satisfying or nourishing, because why do the kids end up go kill themselves?
Yep. You have the... they're brought up in a school system that imprints visual values on them. It pretends or asserts that you must remember them, and to the degree that has an impact, it's hard to reconcile with the postmodern condition when you're out of school.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So that's where the education establishment is really irresponsible. They think just by ramming the old media down your throat that you're saving something. You're doing a Noah's Ark.
But yeah.
It's better to, probably for meaning today, it's like McLuhan used to say, he finds meaning everywhere. If you understand pattern recognition or engage in pattern recognition, you can juggle all these situations and create all kinds of temporary, meaningful patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's demanding us to be very creative in this world.
Yeah.
At least for maintaining some kind of calm.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to be pretty creative.
Yeah. Well, is there a calm under the panic?
Well, you were saying that I got that calm confronting the Android meme, so maybe that's what I'm representing.
Yeah. So you're a post-panic encyclopedia.
Yeah, if you look at my chart, I'm after LaRouche's paranoia, McLuhan's schizophrenia, Thompson is hysteria, Croker's panic, and I'm ecstasy.
Well, I thought you were all 4+.
I am. Glad you noticed that. But ecstasy is in my quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most people in Western developed electronic cultures are stoned. By their cars, their car radio, their Walkmans, or today their Palm Pilots, all these things.
Yeah.
We're in an electronic state of agitation and vibrating particulateness.
Mm-hmm.
That means particles. So what are the questions that come out of this? That's the next section, panic questions.
Panic questions. The question posed by one American reader.
He said, it's to the question.
Mm.
He's saying we respond, just so that people understand what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
To the question posed by one American reader.
Mm-hmm. Quote, is the postmodern scene sadistic? Unquote. We respond that sadomasochism in the postmodern condition is not what it used to be. The postmodern scene, referring to
his
book, works also to show that sadomasochism is now a little sign slide between the ecstasy of catastrophe and the terror of the simulacrum as a, parentheses, disappearing sign of the times.
So the postmodern scene works also to show that sadomasochism is now a little sign slide. That's what you mentioned, sign. Sliding signifiers, is now a little sign slide between the ecstasy of catastrophe and the terror of the simulacrum as a disappearing sign of the times.
Mm-hmm.
So the simulacrum is a disappearing sign. Or, the sign of the times is the sign slide between ecstasy and terror, and it's disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Not even it has any substantiality.
Mm.
more afterimage suggestion.
Has Croker, in your opinion, attained to the kind of sense of freedom that you have?
I don't think I have a sense of freedom. We're different people.
Mm.
It's very different for me.
You,
we have different backgrounds, you know. We have different lives.
You don't have a sense of freedom. You always sound pretty freed up.
Yeah, because I'm...
You, as a matter of fact, you're the personification of frictionless man.
That's right. It doesn't mean that's what I look like, sound like. Doesn't mean I am. Takes some work to be that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't tell how much work I'm doing compared to you.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get inside your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Your pain, I can't feel your proprioceptive self inside there.
Yeah. You're getting the crackling staticky. It keeps coming in and then it pops off. Is there anything you're doing with your phone to create that?
No, I don't know. It's just there. It'll fade out.
Mm.
Okay, so the next sentence is, anyway,
what is sadism in the age of the hyper-real, but the sense of living today on the edge between violence and seduction, between ecstasy and decay?
There's the gap, living in the interval.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that.
Yeah. And why not? The postmodern mood can alternate so quickly between hermeticism and schizophrenia, between the celebration of artifice and nostalgic appeals for the recovery of nature, because the self is now like what the quantum physicists call a, quote, world strip, unquote, across which run in different rivulets of experience, neither fully mediated nor entirely localized. The self is an empty sign, colonized from within by technologies for the body immune, seduced from without by all the fashion tattoos, and energized by a novel psychological condition, the schizoid state of postmodern selves who are, parentheses, simultaneously, predators and parasites. And to the question, must the postmodern scene,
the book,
be so pessimistic? We would respond that hyper-pessimism today is the only realistic basis for a raging will to political action. In this double sense, first, cultural pessimism.
This in a double sense.
Oh. Yeah, this in a double sense. First, cultural pessimism is the only sharpening of the will which permits us to break forever with all the liberal compromises which seek only to save the appearances at the dying days of modernism. The desperate search now for the recuperation of the subject, and then parentheses, in the age of the disappearing self, end of parentheses, the valorization anew of value itself, parentheses, at a time when value is the deepest language of the technological will to the mastery of the social and non-social nature, end of parentheses, the turning back to the critique of the commodity form, in parentheses, in the age of panic money, and the triumphant return of the new historicism, in parentheses, when history was already imploded.
When history has already
imploded into the Baudrillardian scene of a smooth and transparent surface of hypercommunication, end of parentheses. And second, pessimism is a deliberate intellectual strategy for breaking beyond the cyberspace of telemetried bodies and culture. We seek to create a theoretical maneuver in which hypermodernism explodes into the detritus of its own panic senses.
No, it implodes, not explodes. Hypermodernism implodes into the detritus of its own panic scenes.
Okay. Why? It is our convention that the...
It is our conviction.
Yeah. Why, question mark. It is our conviction that the catastrophe has already happened, that we are living in a waiting period, a dead space, which will be marked by increasing and random outbursts of political violence, schizoid behaviors, and an implosion of all the signs of communication as Western culture runs down towards the brilliant illumination of a final burnout.
That's quite a mouthful, eh?
Yeah. But,
he's describing the self.
Yeah.
Let me just, I'm going to read that. It's so good.
There's only a minute left. I don't think you're going to have time to get very far.
Okay. It's only a minute. Well, that's there's a lot, I guess, in that description.
Yeah.
There's two kinds of pessimisms. Cultural pessimism, and pessimism is a deliberate intellectual strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll have to start up with that next session.
Right.
You notice he had waiting in the dead space. There's your panic waiting.
Yeah.
I think, in a way, it predicts the increasing violence in the world that happened in the, at least in this decade.
Oh, yeah.
And this is not the Panic Encyclopedia, which came out in 1989, 3 years after the book we're doing now, The Postmodern Scene. Mm-hmm. But he says Panic Encyclopedia, he thought, described the naughty knots this decade more than...